Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and a real treat for us today because our friend Joe Heschmeyer in the studio with us. This never happens. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Someone complained on Facebook that the quality of my Skype wasn't good enough, so I flew across the country.
Is that why you did it?
Good. Not really, but it happy coincidence timing was.
Thanks. You just recorded a very good, well, I thought it was a very good episode of Focus with us just a few minutes ago, and that'll come out in, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks. No, not a week. It'll probably be 2 or 3 weeks before it's out.
I'm sure the editing people have to, make it look better. But yeah.
But do you want to tease what it's about?
It's about the show Loki. So they've got to weave in the like clips, and they got to do a little bit of special effects. That'll all make sense later on.
Yeah, I think people are going to like it. Our number is 888-318-7884. And here's the deal today. You got to not be Catholic to call because we want to talk to you about why you're not Catholic. So that would include, I can't list everybody who's not Catholic, but let me throw out some of it. Like if you're an atheist, you don't believe in God. Well, we would say to you, why are you not Catholic? And you'd say, I don't believe in that God. And then we would have a nice conversation about it. Or maybe you're a Protestant, a brother or sister, and we say to you, why are you not Catholic? You would say, well, I believe in sola scriptura, or maybe I believe in sola fide, or however you would want to phrase it. Or I don't want to pray to Mary. And then we'll have a conversation about that. 888-318-7884. You just got to be not Catholic. If it's you're not Catholic because you don't like us, you can call. We'd be happy to talk about that. If you're not Catholic because you can't figure out how to join the Catholic Church, we can explain to you how to join. 888-318-7884. So pretty much any non-Catholic person who would like to call and answer the question, why aren't you a Catholic, is welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Now, you and I, Joe, I believe, we're a little bit unusual here at Catholic Answers in that I think we're both cradle Catholics. We were both
It's true.
Born into Catholic families, raised Catholic, mm-hmm. all that stuff. So we never could have called during this hour.
It's true. Well, I got to say maybe a couple things. One, I really like that this kind of hour exists, because I think sometimes people feel like, well, I'm not Catholic, I don't want to call in and kind of interrupt what they're doing.
Oh, I know.
So for listeners who may be tuning in, like, this is not meant to be us preaching to the choir of just having everyone call in and say, we totally agree with everything you believe. And
yeah,
that's bad radio. And more importantly, it doesn't reach people who need to be reached. So if you have a question, if you have an objection, we really do want to hear it. Like, we really do want to try to engage with it. But then the other thing I'd say is I love the reference you just made to the fact that most people in this building are converts. I was talking with a Protestant gentleman on Facebook recently, and he had this idea like, well, you're just really hardcore for the faith because you're a cradle Catholic. If you were a convert, it wouldn't be like that. I thought, you don't know a lot
but have you ever met
Catholic
a convert to
converts,
the Catholic faith?
Yeah. They tend to be some of the best Catholics.
Yeah, 888-318-7884 is the number if you're not a Catholic. And by the way, we'll include in that, you were raised a Catholic, you were baptized a Catholic, maybe you got your first communion and you were confirmed, but at some point you said, nope, it ain't for me. And so you're not, even though technically you're not out, because we just don't let people out. All right, this is not something we do. But you understand, you're not practicing the Catholic faith, so you could call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I don't know if it's true that most of the people here are converts, but there's a very high percentage. Because I was looking in the room here, and we got Mary and Thomas in there. I think both of them raised Catholic. You, Darren, you were not raised Catholic. You came into the church later because of Catholic Answers, I think. And then you and I here, we were baby Catholics. But it does seem like among apologists, it's far yeah. more common among big-time apologists to come into the faith later.
It kind of makes sense. You figure out why you're Catholic in your own journey. You almost have to. Like, in other words, if you came in just because you were getting married, I don't mean that. But people who are intellectually convinced by the faith, they're in a pretty good spot to then explain to other people why they should be Catholic as well. Huh. So it makes sense in a certain way that especially the apologists would skew towards converts. It's easy to take the faith for granted if you grew up Catholic.
Yeah.
When I was in middle school, I had a friend who was from Vietnam. And pretty serious patriot, right? Like, he knew why he was an American and what that was all about.
Ah, right.
And so, not that America is the same as the faith, but it's to say that you can you can take for granted what's so familiar.
Yeah, right, right. And it's so easy to fall into a kind of lack of appreciation of what mm-hmm. you've always had.
Yeah, yep, amen.
888-318-7884. By the way, were you ever taught by nuns when you were little?
No, I went to a high school that had two nuns, but I never had either one of them.
Oh, yeah. Because my kids all went to Catholic school, never had a nun. And I had the nuns when I was a kid. And as an adult now, looking back on it, I know that people like to, the nuns smack your hands. I had like saintly women as nuns, like really. And I always want to stick up for those women religious because they were awesome. And the fact that in a lot of schools, Catholic schools, were staffed by nuns and are not anymore.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
All right, let's go to Alex in Georgia. He wants to start us off listening on the Quest Radio there in Georgia. Glad to have you, Alex. Why are you not a Catholic?
I do not see good evidence for any God. And as a follow-up, a formal argument is the problem of evil, and that is one of many. But it's a very broad, subject, so I would just stick with one, the problem of evil.
And so I really like that you're doing that. Can I ask you a couple follow-up questions to make sure I know kind of where you're coming from? So it sounds like you're an atheist, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And when you say the problem of evil, you just mean like why is there suffering in the world?
Well, that is a very good point. And some theologians would say, or apologists would say, unnecessary suffering. And I don't really consider that evil, but I find it aligns with evil. Why would there be so much suffering? I think that the state of sentient beings is suffering, and which Catholics seem to love and think it's a wonderful thing, suffering. And then there's also just pure evil of like people being mean.
Okay. So moral evil, not just you see the distinction I'm trying to draw out, though. Like, you're not just saying, why are there hurricanes? You're saying, like, why was there the Holocaust?
I would say, why does every single animal have to be eaten alive, and why is there the Holocaust? Not so much hurricanes.
Okay, yeah, I see. I think I see what you mean. So things like suffering as well as moral evil, but not just like natural disasters.
You're right, but I think the tough hurdle is evil. The Holocaust, the BTK killer, I mean,
sure.
Sorry.
Yeah, why is that stuff going on?
Yeah, it's a great question. And look, when Aquinas is discussing the existence of God in the Summa, he makes it his practice to always find the best objections to every position, and he's able to come up with two objections to the existence of God. And one of them is the idea that it doesn't seem like you need God to exist to explain the universe's existence. And the other is that it seems like God doesn't exist because of the problem of evil. So I guess I'd say, Alex, like, I think you've tapped into the right question about the existence of God. Like, this is the big one. If God is all powerful and all loving, why does evil exist? And there have been plenty of, The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis. There's entire books that have been dedicated just to trying to answer that question. I would say the book of Job in the Bible is asking that same question in a real way. And there's always something a little incomplete about the answers. So I want to answer both halves of your question. First, positive evidence for the existence of God. I would say, number one, when we're looking even at something like good and evil, if we mean that in a meaningful sense, we don't just mean, things that we like or things that we don't like. And we don't even mean just pleasurable and painful things, because there are plenty of good things, I think, that we would acknowledge are pleasurable, are painful. Like, people run marathons. Darren in the office here does CrossFit. I don't understand it. It seems like unnecessary suffering to me. But in a case like that, we're not dealing with a moral evil as far as I can tell. I'm hoping that CrossFit can be shown to be a moral evil. But you see what I mean? Like, we mean something bigger than that. We mean something that is contrary to moral goodness in an objective, universal sense, I think. Does that seem like a pretty fair way of kind of framing the issue, Alex?
Yes, I think running is a huge stress. It sends endorphins through your body. It also conditions us because we're hunter-gatherers at heart.
Right.
And by nature.
Right.
And yeah, something contra goodness.
Yeah, yeah. So, but we're talking about real moral goodness and moral evil. And so what's interesting about this is to posit those kind of universal moral standards, we can't just mean things we like or don't like. And we can't just mean things that are conducive or contrary to our culture. We're rather positing a universal moral standard that exists above the level of individual, above the level of culture, above the level of species, which is why we can talk about God as a moral actor. That we mean that it sounds like we agree there is a universal moral law. And then we try to make sense of all of the evil that exists in light of the idea that there is a universal moral lawgiver. So I'd say in terms of evidence for the existence of God, in a world without God, you don't get a universal moral standard in the first place. So you don't actually have the problem of evil in a world without God. Does that make sense? Like, if there were no God, there'd be no moral standard out there for God to allegedly fall short of. Thoughts on that, Alex?
Oh, what happened, Alex?
I don't think there is an objective moral standard, because the BTK killer shows not that everybody does not adhere to some code that's written on our heart.
Well, yeah.
But he was wrong.
Absolutely. People do things that they know are wrong. C.S. Lewis uses the example. So you can't reduce it just to a question of instinct, because within yourself you might find competing instincts, and you have a third voice telling you to choose one set of drives over another set of drives. So he gives the example, if someone's in danger, you have a self-preservation instinct that kicks in, as well as some sort of like herd protection instinct. You want to take care of other humans. And you have this voice telling you inside yourself that you really ought to follow the protecting other people impulse and not following the self-preservation one. And that third voice can't be reduced to either one of the first two. It's not just another impulse. It's not just another instinct, or else you wouldn't know which one to choose. Now, we can still disobey that. And in fact, that voice can get muffled or distorted, but we do find within ourselves this voice of conscience. And so the example he gives is like a piano, where you have white keys and black keys, but then you also have sheet music telling you which keys to play. That you can't just say the conscience is another key, it's just another instinct. That we rather find ourselves, within ourselves, a witness to there being this universal morality. And you're right, we can point to people like the BTK killer who violate that, and each of us, in at least little ways, violate the universal standard of morality. None of us can plausibly claim to perfectly uphold it. But the question here is just, is there such a thing as a universal standard? Because if there isn't, then the problem of evil goes away, because there's no such thing as evil. If there is, then we have to explain where that universal standard comes from, and that points to the existence of a universal lawgiver.
I got to go to a break, so we're going to have to leave it there. Alex, thank you very, very much for the call. I feel like maybe we would want to send one of our books, maybe Answering Atheism, but I don't know what you think.
Yeah,
or,
I think that's
or why
a great
we're
idea.
Catholic. Okay, all right. Well, Alex, if you'd like one of those books, I'm particularly grateful that you got us started, and I realize this is a conversation that could go on much longer and be more fruitful, but I do have to go to the break. So we'll take the break, and if you want to hang on the line, we'll send you a copy of our book, Answering Atheism.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
This is Dr. Ray Guarendi from The Doctor Is In. You call in, we will talk about what matters to you in your life. People, circumstances, emotions, struggles. We can put our heads together, maybe raise both of our IQs to help you solve the problems of life and to use your faith to get even smarter.
The Doctor Is In with Dr. Ray Guarendi. Tomorrow afternoon, 1 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Why aren't you a Catholic? That's the question we're asking you. And folks have been kind enough to call us, folks who are not Catholic, to let us know why they're not Catholic and engage in that conversation with us. It's a conversation that we always find interesting and rewarding. If one of the reasons that you're not Catholic has to do with that whole Pope thing, I'd recommend Joe's book to you, Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. Don't hold it up to me. Hold it up to the camera. There's a camera right there. It's on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. We're going to New York City now. New York City. Jason in New York City watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Jason, with your no, I shouldn't say it that way. I should say, Jason, why aren't you Catholic?
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you.
So I'm, if I'm being completely transparent, I'm calling on behalf of my mother, who, God has slowly started the conversion process to Catholicism in me. And I'm trying to get my mom to come along, but one of her hesitations, and I would say one of my hesitations as well, is we come from a long line of Lutherans, and, in our family records, we don't have any account of anyone being Catholic, although, you know, it's obvious at one point they would have been. We feel like there's a sense of sort of betraying our great-grandparents and our grandparents in the way that we were brought up by converting, and I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, first of all, praise God that you have been open to the movements that it sounds like have already been going on. And that you're having these kind of good conversations with your mom and that she seems like she's at least interested in these things. It's a really good question. And I think you've already answered it in part the way I would have, which is, well, if you want to be really faithful to your family genealogy, if you go back far enough, it was Catholic. Lutherans don't just come out of thin air. Lutherans come from the Catholic Church and from somebody breaking off of what their parents taught them. So I think that's one way. But the other way is it's not really... You want people who love Christ. And if you have a beautiful Lutheran heritage, it's because people are trying to follow Christ as they see fit. And so you're honoring the best elements of that heritage when you say yes to Christ, when you follow him. And you just have maybe a clearer vision of that than some of your ancestors may have. But then the third thing I say is in Matthew chapter 10, verse 35 to 38, Jesus says, I've come to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. In other words, family is a good. It's a God-given good, but it is not the highest good. You know, there are entire, you know, pagan cultures that convert, leaving beside, you know, like the tradition of their ancestors because they see that the true God has entered history and is inviting them into full communion with him and his church. We should want that. We should want full communion with the true God. We should want the Eucharist, body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. We should want to be part of the church that Christ founded and wants us to be part of more than we just keep, you know, the family peace or keep going in the way that each generation has gone in the past.
All right. Thank you. That's very helpful. And, you know, I appreciate everything the Catholic Answers does. You guys really know your stuff. It's really impressive.
Well, thank you, Jason. If you'd like, I'd be happy to send you Trent's book, Why We're Catholic, as more questions come up. Maybe you'd like to thumb through that book and see what you find there. Really, thank you very, very much for the call. I always feel very grateful to the callers on the why are you not Catholic? Like, well, I'm not Catholic. None of your business. I mean, I can see someone, but it's very generous when folks call and have these conversations with us. So, Jason, hang on the line if you'd like that book. Going to go now to Omaha, Nebraska, 102.7 FM. Chris in Omaha, go ahead with your question. No, I keep saying it wrong. On this day, I'm supposed to say, Chris, why aren't you Catholic?
How are you doing? Okay, so I was Catholic at one point. I did convert, but then I later converted to the Eastern Orthodox Church. And I guess what I found in Catholicism was a rupture in the tradition. What I was reading in the books before I converted to the Catholic Church wasn't what I found on the ground. What I found in the Orthodox Church was what I found in the books. So the Lex Orandi, Lex Currendi is, it's more appropriate. The Orthodox actually maintain and hold to the traditions of the early apostolic church, not just the medieval church, which I'd say the Roman Catholic Church more resembles. An example of this, right? So the Orthodox Church, according to the Catholic Church, has completely valid sacraments. We have a valid Eucharist, a priesthood, confession, all of that. So I guess I would actually flip the question on you and say, how is it possible that a church can have what even the Catholic Church would consider the source and summit of the faith, the Eucharist? How can it have a true Eucharist and a true priesthood if it is not part of the body of Christ? If it is in schism, if it's separated itself from the body, how is it possible that we have maintained a valid Eucharist without having the papal primacy over our different Orthodox jurisdictions? What I'm saying is we seem to have better maintained tradition and also, in fact, have maintained tradition and apostolic succession and sacrament, all without having a pope.
All right.
Yeah, Chris, I think that's it.
Oh. Primacy is central. How are these things possible?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer is because there is a difference between schism and heresy. That schism, you're breaking off communion, and in heresy, you're actually replacing the truth with falsehood. So even within Orthodoxy right now, the Byzantines are not in communion with the Russians. So one of the two groups is schismatic if you think either of them is the one true church. But there's no question from either a Catholic or an Orthodox perspective that they still have valid sacraments, that they still have the priesthood, they still have the Eucharist, right? So how would you answer that? I mean, your own question would seem to sort of be self-refuting, right? Because the Eastern Orthodox are not in communion with other Eastern Orthodox.
Chris?
Byzantine. I would say that hello?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I think we lost you for just a second there.
Okay, sorry. I'm driving in the middle of nowhere. It's Nebraska. That's how it is.
Hey, I'm from Kansas. I get it.
Right on. Yeah, okay, so that's true. So there is currently a division right now between the Greek Patriarchate and the Russian. That's true, right? Now, on the ground, there is still communion between the two to a degree, right? I guess, but my point would be, I see what you're saying. And within Orthodoxy, we would say that the ability to separate from churches that are problematic, maybe for a time, is what maintains the health of the body, right? Because if one part starts to go, you know, a little crazy, Orthodoxy has a self, you know, an internal mechanism to maintain itself by saying, well, we're not going to be in communion with y'all until you get your stuff together. Now, within the Catholic Church, what you have is it's whole hog, all together. And so when you know, one pope goes off the rails and starts, you know, leading us down a I'll leave it there.
Sure.
You know, the whole church is forced to go along with that and has no recourse to separate and say, without being, you know, set of a contest or whatever, without saying, hey, we're not going to be a part of this, you know, craziness until you get your act together.
Yeah, so let me draw out that distinction,
exactly,
if I may,
how
there,
the Orthodox,
Chris,
have maintained such good tradition.
Yeah, I think I would make this distinction. There's a difference between schism, where you break away from the true church, and something like excommunication, where the true church removes an erring set of brethren. And so that assumes the existence of an identifiable local true church. The Roman Catholic Church very clearly is able to say it is the Church of Rome, that if Rome breaks away from Constantinople, Constantinople is an error. The Orthodox don't have a clear principle by which they know if Constantinople and Moscow go into schism one from another, which they have, there's no principle of unity. And so I'd say this, like the biblical model that we see going back to the New Testament is that Peter has this clear hierarchy. He has this clear primacy given to him that he's actually given something more than the other apostles. When you go back to the earliest writings, things like Ignatius writing to the Romans in about 107, when he talks about the Church of Rome presiding in love. When you talk, go even before that with Clement of Rome, saying that he's speaking on behalf of the Holy Spirit when he's writing to the Church of Corinth, like very clearly from the earliest days, the Church of Rome possessed this kind of authority. And we see it all throughout church history. And so I'd say the Catholic Church has been totally faithful to that and just has a clearer sense of where this unity is coming from.
I got to leave it there. Thank you so much, Chris, for that call. Why aren't you Catholic? That's our topic today. Lots of folks on the line willing to have that conversation with us. Very grateful for that. Be back with more of those calls for Joe Heschmeyer right after this. Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Hi, this is Johnette Williams. We bring you the truth of the Catholic faith on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest this hour. Next hour, Father Sebastian Walsh will be here with us, Father, the author of the book Always a Catholic. And we're going to continue the same theme in the second hour. It'll be for non-Catholics. So if you're not, that's right? You're looking at me like, oh yeah, okay. Because sometimes I get confused. I don't know if you know this after 5 years of working with me, but sometimes I get confused, Aaron. But okay, I got that one right. Second hour will also be Why Aren't You Catholic? And we just love having these conversations. And now we get to go all the way to Sweden. Stefan in Gothenburg, Sweden, watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Stefan. Why aren't you a Catholic?
I would probably say that it's the Marian dogma, like or the prayers, or like some of the attributes that's attributed to her.
Excellent.
So we can take like any of those.
Would you say that in general,
you're most prepared for?
Is the objection that Mary is too exalted in the Catholic Church?
I'm actually looking at a quote from, I think it was Alphonsus, St. Alphonsus, for example, that's like if we're going to go for her attributes.
Give it to us. Give us the quote.
Yeah. It's a bit further down. It says that as the mother then must have the same power as the son, justly was Mary made omnipotent by Jesus, who is omnipotent. It being, however, always true that there's a son is omnipotent by nature, or mother is so by grace. and I can continue more in the, on that if you want. Or
well, I'm getting the idea of it. Do you want to respond to just that part?
Yeah. I'd love to respond to that. I think there's a few things to know. One is that the things St. Alphonsus Liguori says are not universally like church doctrine. Like it is certainly possible to just say like, oh, well, he might have just said that way too strongly. And even among the saints, that's just sometimes the case. So I want to kind of draw attention to that. Like it's possible to just say like, I wouldn't have said things that way and that's okay. The second is a lot of the sometimes exaggerating sounding Marian things are best understood in their kind of cultural context. And St. John Henry Newman gives the example that you wouldn't want to read a love letter as a police report. Like you want to recognize when someone is being sort of dramatically over the top or rhetorically over the top. And this is true even within scripture itself. When Jesus says, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out, he doesn't mean to be read in a literal police report kind of way. So that's an important thing to kind of recognize. Like if your kid gives you a number one dad mug, that doesn't mean that they literally have done a poll of all the dads and think you're literally the best one. They're expressing something in kind of exaggerated language that's true if understood in the proper context of what's being said. In terms of the specific of Liguori talking about Mary being omnipotent through grace, he's not saying she's divine. He is saying that like she's in total union with God in this process, what we do call divinization or theosis. But there's a sense in which this is true also of all of the saints. In 1 John chapter 3, it says we're already children of God. What we shall be has not yet been revealed, but we know that when we see him, we will be like him. And so in 1 Peter, it talks about us becoming partakers of the divine nature. And so you can go on and on and on. St. Paul talks about us passing from glory into glory. There's this idea that we're growing up into union with the second person of the Trinity and the Son. This is part of the idea in Ephesians 1 of the whole Christ being Jesus Christ plus the church, that the destiny we have is that God became man so that we can become gods, or we can become God, meaning like we can become totally united to God such that his will and our will are just one will in a certain sense. That happens by grace, not by nature. Like Mary is not a divine being. You and I are not divine beings. The saints are not divine beings. But we are called to participate in divinity through unmerited grace.
Stefan, what do you make of that?
Well, like there is a point about things being like talking certain language, but the thing is like there are also several others. I can't remember any historical, but several of the Marian prayers, like that's easily Googleable, is giving her way too much power. And
I haven't really
seen like the Catholic Church like doing an official statement that no, they're.
Well, you know, you don't have to look one up. I'll just throw one out there because we pray in the one of the Marian prayers, "Hail, Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, our life, our sweetness, and our hope." And that drives a lot of people crazy that we would address Mary as our life, our sweetness, and our hope. Is that the kind of thing that bugs you?
Well, this one here, I can jump in like in the middle. I recommend myself to thee, in thy hands I place my eternal salvation to thee. Do I entrust my soul? Count me among thy most devoted servants. Take me under thy protection, and it's enough for me. For thou protect me, dear mother, I fear nothing, not from my sins, because thou obtain pardon of them, nor from the devils, because thou art more powerful than all of hell together, nor even from Jesus, my judge himself, because by one prayer from thee he will be appeased, but one thing I fear, but in the hour of temptation, I may neglect to call on thee and thus perish miserably.
That is very exalted language.
Extremely. And I have, just speaking personally, have often found that kind of language to be more problematic than helpful. But I think there are a few things that are worth saying. First, a lot of that prayer is actually rooted in an ancient Christian prayer called the Sub Tuum Praesidium, which just says, beneath your compassion, we take refuge, O Mother of God, or O Theotokos. Do not despise our petitions in time of trouble, but rescue us from dangers, only pure, only blessed one. We have a written copy of that on what's called the Rylands Papyrus 470 that dates back to about 250. We don't know how old the prayer is, but there's like basically no chance we have the very first copy. What this means is that that kind of prayer is actually being said by the earliest Christians. That this is not some weird later like medieval thing or some modern Roman Catholic thing. Like, no, no, this is as far back as we find records of Christian prayer. You have these kind of exalted sounding prayers to Mary that recognize she has this special union with her son, not by virtue of some, you know, merit apart from grace, but because she is full of grace, because God has chosen to listen to her prayers, to unite her so closely in the plan of salvation. And so, you know, just like we see throughout Scripture, the prayers of the saints being very efficacious. In James chapter 5, it talks about the prayers of a righteous man are efficacious. Likewise, the prayers of the mother of Jesus are really powerful. He cares about that. He listens to that. We see it in John 2, the wedding feast of Cana, where Mary says, do whatever he tells you. And Jesus performs his first miracle, when from the text, it kind of seems like he wasn't going to, were it not for her prayerful intervention and just asking him to do this. Now, notice in that, it's not that Mary's more powerful than Jesus. Like, in as much as Mary is powerful, it's because she's totally trusting in Jesus. He's still the one actually doing stuff. She's able to influence him because of her incredible faith, her incredible fidelity, her incredible devotion to him. She's not a rival to him. She's an extremely fervent devotee of him.
Stefan, we got to leave it there because it's time for us to take a break again. But thank you very, very much for the call, and I hope we'll get to talk again. It's a great pleasure for us to get a call from Sweden. But not every day somebody calls us from Sweden. Joe, I think you see this little thing right here? That's an ad that I'm supposed to read. Last time I read that, you got in trouble with listeners because I messed the ad up, and you said to me, how do you even have a job? So go ahead, read it.
All right.
And I won't mess you up. I'll just go ahead.
Catholic Answers Rewards. Have you heard about the great new Catholic Answers Rewards program? It's our new program at shop.catholic.com where pretty much everything you do earns you points. You can cash in for great Catholic resources. You can get points every time you shop, when you sign up for an account, do a review, refer a friend. 10 ways to earn points and all. And it's so easy. Just visit shop.catholic.com/rewards today and get started. That's shop.catholic.com/rewards. I was so close.
Oh, I tell you what, I'm humbled by that, Joe. I am humbled by your skill. Nicely done. Very, and you didn't even mention Safeway once.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the greatest defenders of Christ's divinity.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Athanasius of Alexandria fought against the Arian heresy that questioned the divinity of Christ. He once condemned the Arians as opposers of Christ who had dug a pit of ungodliness. It was said of him, Athanasius contra mundum, Athanasius against the world, but for Christ. He died in 373.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, who, yes, he picks on me sometimes on the air, but he's my very good friend. And he even brought me donuts the other day. And I say by me, I mean you brought them to us, but
Actually, my wife brought them.
Oh, your wife brought them? Oh, well, she's my friend.
I encouraged her to bring them, but yes.
Why aren't you?
She's a good one. She's literally my better half.
She is. It's very. Yeah. It's obvious when the two of you are together. And they're beautiful children, by the way.
Yeah, again, beautiful. I give her credit for that.
Yeah, I found it very charming when we were at the beach and you lost one of them, but we got that child back. So, Brian, right here in California, watching on YouTube, Brian, why aren't you a Catholic?
Hey Joe, this is Brian here in California.
Hi.
Thank you for the show. Yeah, I'm not Catholic because your teachings on the authority of somebody in power, like a deity, a priest, you teach that the people abused by these people that are in a relationship with them have no moral right or standard to voice their parameters of being in a relationship with that person in power. So if it's a deity that's committing that's telling you to kill your kid, like Isaac and Abraham, if it's a deity that's committing infanticide to the Pharaoh's children, if it's a husband that's abusing his wife because she didn't wipe off the can opener property, or if it's a priest that's abusing children, all these people affected by these abusers in y'all's moral system have no right or authority to demand an equitable treatment in that relationship. They just have to accept the person in power, and they are never allowed to judge them as evil for their action.
What is so? Let me speak to those are really two very, very different issues. One is it seems like God is evil, and one is there are evil human beings and evil human actions that human beings do. In the second case, the church is actually very clear that in cases of either physical or even like mental abuse, separation is permissible and sometimes even really encouraged, even in a married couple. The fact that we don't believe in divorce and remarriage does not mean and should not be interpreted to mean that we think you need to stay in an abusive relationship. It just means we acknowledge that it is an abusive relationship. I'd give this analogy. Like if your parents are just awful to you as a kid, you might need to be emancipated from them, but they don't actually cease to become your parents. They could just be bad parents. Likewise, if your spouse is abusive, you might need to be, you know, divorced civilly. You might need to be separated. We just think that doesn't make them not your spouse. They might just be a bad spouse. And one of the reasons that matters is because there is such a thing as a hope of redemption. There are people who grew up in abusive households where later in life there's reconciliation, the parent actually changes. Or there are cases where a horrible spouse becomes less horrible, becomes actually better. That's not saying accept the abuse. It is recognizing that even people who do horrible things may still be redeemed. That should not come at the expense of you need to sit there and take it. Appropriate remedies ought to be taken. Likewise, in the case of an abusive priest, if you go to any diocesan website, they'll give you the resources of who to call. You should call the police, and you should call. There's a designated person who can actually handle these things that can... make sure that this doesn't continue to happen. I'd just say, please don't go back to an abuser thinking that this is what God wants or this is what you're supposed to be doing. That is very much the opposite of what the Catholic Church teaches. Now, it's true, Catholics have often fallen short in this regard. They've often failed to live out Catholic teaching. But please don't mistake that for the Church's teaching itself. Does that part make sense?
That makes sense to me, but I want you to address the evil God part then.
Yes.
So that was, you said that's the first part.
Yes. So the idea of God as a morally evil actor is really a confusing and sort of murky one in a few ways. First, the idea that like everyone dies, that's different than God being a murderer. So all of us are going to die in a way that God could, you know, conceivably just keep you alive. So if you start equating divine action with human action in that way, God is the author of life. These are his lives to do with as he wills in an ultimate sense. In the same way that I can't steal my own car, God isn't stealing the life of someone who, whether they die in their sleep or in a flood or in 10 plagues, everyone will ultimately die. So trying to judge God by human standards, as if God stands in the same relationship to us as we stand with one another, is confused. Then the other thing I would say with that is, again, I kind of alluded to this in the very first call tonight, that you're holding God to a universal moral standard, but the only reason universal moral standards exist is because there is a God. So it doesn't, like, it's a self-refuting argument to say that the lawgiver violates this universally binding moral law. Now, obviously, a whole lot more could be said. I know that's not a totally satisfactory answer. There are explanations for the particulars that if we had more time and space, we could go into, you know, why did the plagues happen, or why did this, that, or the other thing happen. I would say only God is not acting immorally. It only sometimes appears that he is because we don't have a fuller picture, and we're trying to judge him by our standards instead.
Brian, thanks very, very much. Lots of folks on the line. I'm going to keep moving, try to get as many as I can on with Joe. But also the second hour, Father Sebastian Walsh will be here, a very, very fine and helpful apologist himself. And so if you would, if you are not a Catholic and you'd like to talk, continue this conversation after this hour, we're going to continue at the next hour. Julian in Cincinnati listening on Sacred Heart Radio. You are up next, Julian. Why are you not a Catholic?
So I have a lot of reasons, but tonight I'm just going to voice four of these reasons.
Okay.
And I also want to thank you for having this segment. And I also want to talk to Joe. I think you have a very common voice. You sound very compassionate when crazy people like me call in with my crazy questions.
You don't sound crazy at all.
Like respects like, Julian. We crazy people have to stick together.
All right, go ahead. You got four reasons you wanted to give us.
I have four. The first quick one is, the woman in the book of Revelation, chapter 17, mm-hmm. riding the beast with the golden cup in her hand, we believe that that's the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. The woman also represents the Church according to the Bible. And in Revelation, chapter 12, you said that it is Mary that is going up to heaven when this has nothing to do with Mary but the Church. And then the Bible says in Isaiah, chapter 8 and verse 20, to the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to these things, the law and the testimony, it's because they are false. And then the last thing I would say on this is, you have taken away the holiness of the Seventh-day Sabbath and placed it on Sunday. And I think Peter would be rolling over in his grave if he knew that you called him the first pope.
Okay, let's unpack a few of these things. Is it safe to say you're coming from a Seventh-day Adventist background?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I was baptized while christened in a Catholic church, and I asked God to open my eyes, and that's what he did.
Okay. Well, great. Let's unpack a few of those things. So, first of all, we'll talk about Saturday versus Sunday worship, because that's one of the distinctive differences, and you alluded to that. One of the false teachings that Ellen Goldwhite, the founder of Seventh-day Adventism, kind of put forward is that Constantine changed this, and no historian will accept that. Like, no historian thinks that Sunday worship begins in the 4th century, because there's clear evidence of it in the 1st and 2nd century. In the book called The Didache, it talks about worshiping on Sunday. In St. Justin Martyr's First Apology in the 150s, it talks about it as well. If you want a really good, much fuller treatment, Pope John Paul II has an apostolic letter called Dies Domini, D-I-E-S-D-O-M-I-N-I, which just means Day of the Lord. And it traces from apostolic times how this happened. So in the book of Revelation, it talks about worshiping on the Lord's Day. And we know from the Didache and from Justin Martyr that the Lord's Day is Sunday. So we see even in the Bible itself, people coming together to worship on Sunday. The question is why? And the answer is because Christ fulfills the law. He even fulfills the Ten Commandments. And that this honor is transferred to the day of the resurrection. That's a really important thing to grapple with, because if you're going to claim the Roman Catholic Church changed that, then you have to say the Roman Catholic Church is the church mentioned in a positive way in the book of Revelation, that it is the church that St. John is a part of. That's going to directly answer the idea that St. John is writing to warn against the rise of the Roman Catholic Church in Revelation 17. So let's unpack a couple more things. So you talk about the woman riding the beast. And in Revelation 12, and the Babylon in Revelation is situated on the seven hills. And Babylon seems very clearly to be a reference to Rome. And Ellen Goldwhite and others have suggested, well, Rome equals Roman Catholic Church. The issue with that is that, no, this is very clearly the Roman Empire. This is not the church. And one of the ways we know that, just if you want to get into the geographical question, is that the Roman Catholic Church is not situated on one of the seven hills of Rome. The Vatican is situated on the hill Vaticanus, which was outside the walls. And so it's not a reference. Like, if you were trying to refer to the Vatican as the evil one, you wouldn't mention the seven hills that it's not on. You would find some other way of referring to the church. So the problem is, yes, it's about Rome. No, it's not about the Catholic Church. It's only because of this conflation where Protestants began referring to the Catholic Church as Rome that this kind of confusion sets in among certain Protestants. Now, notice, like, the Catholic Church does not usually refer to herself as, you know, the Roman Catholic Church. She's just the Catholic Church. Okay. Then the other thing is the woman enthroned in heaven. Sorry, that is Revelation 12. Revelation 17 is the other one. The woman enthroned in heaven, well, how do we know that this is a reference to Mary? Well, because it says she gives birth to the one who's going to rule the world, and that's Christ. That's the church didn't give birth to Christ, and so it doesn't fit as neatly to say that it's the church. Now, there's a sense, to be sure, in which both Israel and the church are referenced symbolically in Revelation 12, but in the literal sense in Revelation 12, verse 5, where it says that she brought forth a male child who's going to rule the nations with a rod of iron, that is clearly Jesus. That's explicitly Jesus. That's a reference from the Psalms, one of the Messianic Psalms. And so who's the mother of Jesus? You can say metaphorically the mother of Jesus is Israel or the church, but the most obvious answer to who's the mother of Jesus is the Virgin Mary.
Okay, so then what do you do with the text that says, to the law and to the testimony? So you mentioned that the Sunday was kept by, it wasn't changed by the Seventh Day, by the Pope or by the Roman Catholic Church, but we see in the book of Acts that even the Gentiles were keeping Sabbath on Saturday. That was in the book of Acts. So we see right there that even the early Christians were keeping Sabbath before the Roman power messed with it.
Yeah, so the earliest practice seems to be that they would go and listen to the readings from the Old Testament and synagogue worship on Saturday, and then they would come together themselves on the Lord's Day and offer the breaking of the bread, which is the Eucharist. So they would have these kind of two halves to their worship, and then as predicted by Christ in the Gospel of John, they're thrown out of the synagogues, and in the late first century, they create in Jamnia, some of the anti-Christian rabbis create a series of anti-Christian prayers that everyone in the synagogues required to pray. This was a way of excluding Christians from that worship. So from that point on, they just worship together exclusively, communally, on Sunday. Now, we still go to Mass every day. Like, if you want to go to Mass every Saturday as a Catholic, you can. It's encouraged. We have Mass every Saturday. The idea that we're against Saturday worship is totally false. Then the other thing I would say is, in terms of Isaiah, there is this fulfillment of all of this, right? So Colossians 2, verse 16 says, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. That you shouldn't be legalistic about the Sabbath is pretty explicitly right there in the New Testament. Jesus also says that man is not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath is made for man. He's the Lord of the Sabbath. So he has authority over all of this. So taking a sort of legalism that would force Jesus and the apostles to continue Old Testament worship is contrary to what Jesus is doing in the New Testament.
I tell you what, I'll leave it here because we'll be going back and forth on that, but I appreciate you taking
it. Yeah, thank you so much for your question. I appreciate you even calling in to ask the questions.
Thank you, Julian. If you would like, we'll send you our book by our colleague Trent Horn. It's called Why We're Catholic. If you'd like it, we'd be happy to send it to you. It's entirely up to you. We definitely can get mail to Cincinnati. So just hang on the line and give your information to Thomas if you want a copy of the book, Why We're Catholic. If not, that's fine. And call us back another time. We're going to continue our discussions with non-Catholics, so long as you're all willing to call. If you're not a Catholic, the next hour is entirely for you. We're holding off on taking any calls from Catholics. 888-318-7884. Father Sebastian Walsh will be here. And that means we say goodbye to Joe. Joe!
It's been a pleasure.
It's been so nice to have you in the studio. You're much nicer to me when you're in the studio than when
I'm within striking distance. So.
Is that it? Is it fear, Joe, that keeps you honest? Okay, fine. That's fine. Joe Heschmeyer is the author of Pope Peter, defending the church's most distinctive doctrine in a time of crisis. It's available now at shop.catholic.com. Right back with Father Sebastian Walsh and your calls, if you're not Catholic, to 888-318-7884.